Anything Goes is a 1934 Cole Porter musical that's been revived multiple times and is produced all around the world. The story varies from version to version and is largely incomprehensible when written down, but the gist is that this is a madcap farce set, where else, on a ship. It follows Billy Crocker, a stowaway, who's in love with the heiress, Hope Harcourt, who's engaged to Lord Evelyn Oakley. But Billy has help from nightclub singer Reno Sweeney and public enemy number 13, Moonface Martin. Hijinks ensue. My guest today is David Lohr, who is a theater writer and performer, perhaps most relevantly on the Incomparable Radio Theater here on the network. I hope you enjoy our conversation about Anything Goes. Hello, David.
Hello, Quinn.
How are you doing tonight?
Pretty good. I mean, I get to talk about my favorite show. Come on.
Yeah, it's always the best night. And what are we talking about?
We are talking about Anything Goes from 1934 by Cole Porter.
How did you first get into this show? Like, what made you start listening to it and love it so much?
Well, you know, it's funny. I grew up, as Incomparable listeners know, I grew up in a doll museum run by my grandparents. I feel like I have to just sort of soft pedal that now. It's like it's a running joke now. But I did. I really did grow up in like a 1940s kind of world where all the music and all the references were my grandparents' stuff. And it's not that my mother didn't have contemporary things or that, you know, I didn't pick up on that too. But it was just sort of like I got to have this dual childhood, right, in these two time periods. And so there was a lot of Broadway and a lot of Tin Pan Alley and Gershwin and Porter and Kern and all of those guys. That was just part of my childhood. And so I knew most of the songs already, but I didn't really know them in any kind of context. And flash forward several years, and I was in high school. I was working for both the school paper and for the local newspaper as the high school reporter. What's the news at the high school? And
wait, I did that. That's so cute.
Hey, yeah, see, it's fun. I still have people just this past year. I had people online who were like, wait a minute, are you? Oh, my God, I read that every week. And this
is
30 years later. It's crazy. And it was a tiny paper. Even though it was the Princeton area, it was still a tiny paper. But our school, when, let's see, it would have been my sophomore year, the spring musical was Anything Goes. And I knew the song. I was like, well, at least I want to see it because now I get to see the context. And I was already, you know, a musical comedy fool at that point. And, maybe it was freshman year because it was 86. That's right. I'm okay. So I got to see it, and our school did shows 2 weeks, two weekends in a row. And so after seeing it the 1 week and falling in love with it, farce is like my specialty, and I don't always write it. I don't always get to do it, but I've tried to work it into the radio theater sometimes. There are episodes that are structured like bedroom farce. And that's all musical comedy is, usually. And it just so happens that the lead actor in the show was utterly delightful. I mean, you go to a high school musical, it's fine. It's a lot of the Music Man reaction of, that's my boy, that's my daughter, yay! This guy was fantastic. It turned out, well, I'll get to that. Hang on. So it was a great show. It's a great show. And I talked to the drama teacher and I said, you know, I'm doing this thing with the local paper. Could I do like a behind the scenes thing for the following weekend and, you know, just write about the show and write about the theater program? And she was like, oh my God, yes. So the following week we had like three articles all about this show. One was for one performance I got to sit in the orchestra pit. Now, the thing about that school, it didn't have an orchestra pit. The stage was a three-quarter thrust with no wings, no discernible. I mean, it was just everything was out there. No curtains, nothing. And you had a giant wall, and everything came out from behind the wall. And the orchestra was really in a loft above and behind the wall. So it was a kind of, you know, you had a little closed-circuit camera, and the conductor is watching the little tiny monitor. and that's how he does the cues for everything. It was complicated for mid to late 80s. And so it was fascinating. It made for a really good article. And then the following night, I did it from front row. What is it like seeing it from the front row? And, yeah, I mean, it's just this whole big, you know, splashy press for, you know, tiny little town in mid-central New Jersey. And so, you know, the guy who was the lead actor in it made a deal. The drama teacher knew that he would knock this one out of the park. She had always wanted to do it. She waited until she had someone that she thought could knock it out of the park. And, you know, someone who could be suave and witty and debonair and charming and who could dance. And, you know, maybe he's not Fred Astaire because it is still high school, but he can fake it really well. And he said, all right, there's not really, I've never been interested in this kind of thing, but I'll do that show if you let me pick the show for my senior year. And he was a junior that year. And she said, all right, fair enough. What do you want to do? He wanted to be Fagin in Oliver, which that was a jump. That was complicated. He knocked that out of the park too. Total 180 degrees from this. That guy is James Murphy of LCD Sound System. I swear to God.
Oh my God.
If you can picture him doing the suave Fred Astaire lead in Anything Goes, that's him. And he sold it. It was amazing. It cracks me up every time I see him now, because I'm like, I remember you when, oh my God. So that was the first time I got to see it. And the following year at Lincoln Center, they did the big revival where they revised the script and they went all out, and Patti LuPone was the star, and they sort of refurbished the whole thing. And I said, oh, well, I have to go see that. And of course, you know, I don't have a lot of money at the time, and I live an hour away by train. But of course, my dad commuted every day by train. I knew how to get around the city by myself at that point. And so I scrimped and saved. And even then, you know, to me it was expensive at the time. And I look back on it now, it was $37. My seat was $37 to see this amazing production. But I went and saw that, and it's still one of the best stagings of a musical I've ever seen. It was a really smart set design, really, really good casting, and a fantastic seat to boot. And that's still, of all the shows I've seen, and, you know, I work in theater, I see a lot of shows every year, that is still one of the best productions of anything I've ever seen. So, you know, I actually have the Lincoln Center poster hanging over my desk as like the centerpiece of my office. And I have the London version of the poster, which they redid. I fell in love with the poster art of James McMullen, who does all the Lincoln Center posters and still does them, just because of his Anything Goes posters. I think I like this show. I don't know. You tell me.
It sounds like you might like it a little bit. Let's talk about that, you know?
let's break this down, David.
Well, no, seriously. Well, I'm joking around, but actually, let us break this down, because
absolutely.
I mean, obviously, when you come into seeing a show when you're in high school and younger, like, these things tend to latch onto our souls, at least theater people. Mm-hmm. But
oh God, yes.
Yeah.
I still have all of Guys and Dolls memorized from senior year, which will be 30 years next year.
Oh, wow. When I was like a tiny, like 10 or 11 year old, I could rap every word to In the Heights.
Oh, wow.
Not well, but wow. I could do it.
I'm disturbed. I was walking around the other day and just, I had it in my head and I started going, lights up on Wuthering Heights up. And no, nope.
So close.
Stay off the moors. No.
But besides that, youth getting into this kind of show, what is it in particular about Anything Goes that you love so much?
It's basically a quintessential farce. You've got mistaken identities, assuming identities. You've got the hero with the heart of gold who's trying to win the ingenue that he's always loved, but he's lost her to someone else. You've got, you know, really fun songs for the chorus. and just some of the best songs ever written in that period for musical theater. Songs that rip the doors off the back of the theater, right? And I mean, you had Ethel Merman in the original cast, so she really could rip them off. So, you know, it's what's not to love? And originally, it had a book by P.G. Wodehouse, which, you know, of course he knows how to do farce. Now, not much of that remains, and I'm sure we'll get into that, but at least it started from that pedigree, right? And they were still, even when they were revising it on the fly before it opened, they still had that kind of story in mind, that type of story, that style. And it really shows. Now, the version we did at our high school was the 1963 version, which camped it up and changed a lot of the songs and streamlined it a bit. It's still fun. That version had Hal Linden, who I knew at that point only from Barney Miller. And Hal Linden was he was the ingenue. He was the sweet hero. And I went, as soon as the show had come down, I went and got that version of the album, or that version of the score. And it's very different from the Lincoln Center version. The Lincoln Center version is not exactly a restoration, but it restores a lot of songs that they took out. And I like it much better in retrospect. And that seems to be the version that everyone does now, is the 1987 version.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it looks like they revived it again in 2011, and it's pretty much very similar to the 1987 version as well.
Right, right. And I have to say, I almost got to see that one because I kind of wanted to because Sutton Foster. Mm-hmm. And I have a friend who can get me tickets to most things pretty easily. And I said, you know, I was in the city. He said, do you want to see a show while you're here? I said, well, I would love to see this Anything Goes. And he says, oh, Roundabout Theater. That's the one theater I can't get tickets from. Oh, okay. So I never saw it. I've seen clips of it on YouTube, like behind the scenes of rehearsals. And I'm not crazy about the orchestrations. I'm kind of glad. I listened to the cast album at some point, and I was almost kind of glad I didn't go see it in retrospect. It was like, oh, you're doing that to the songs. Huh. Okay. So.
It's always hard when someone reinterprets something that you love.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm sure it was fine because Joel Grey and Sutton Foster, but yeah. Mm. I like these versions.
Brief question. How do I get a friend who can get me tickets to Broadway shows?
Stick with me, kid. I'll introduce you.
Excellent.
Because he's still in New York. He hates it when I do this voice. This is my New York voice. But I just saw him over the weekend.
You just did like three different accents in one sentence.
Totally. New York is a cosmopolitan place filled with all kinds of people. I'm trying to do Regis Philbin. Come on. it's as well controlled as my Scottish accent. Hi, James.
I was not very familiar with this show before you said that you wanted to do it. I knew the song Anything Goes because I'm alive. and I had seen that. I saw the Tony performance when they revived it in 2011, but that was basically my only familiarity with it. And right. So I didn't really know what to expect. And this is such a quintessential 30s old style musical.
Oh yeah. It is the template, basically. I mean, there were others before it in a very similar style, but when we think of just basic musical comedy, this is the quintessential. This is the default. Everything else just borrows tricks from this or rings changes on it. But that's farce, you know.
And I had to read the Wikipedia plot description about three times before any of it made sense. I was like, what?
And it's so weird. I've seen so many different versions of it now because they did a movie version at the time with Bing Crosby, Ethel Merman, I forget. Was it Victor Moore? Maybe it was Victor Moore. And for whatever reason, they changed the name to Top of the Pops. It's like, okay. They took out most of the songs and replaced them with different songwriters' stuff, and they changed the plot, you know, about a third of the way into it. It really has nothing. It's on a ship. It's on a ship, and you have Ethel Merman. That's about it. And then they did another version of it for television in the 50s, and I think that's on Hulu now. It's on one of the services, but I'm pretty sure it's Hulu. And I think that one has Frank Sinatra, and I forget who else. It's okay. It's a little more straight compared to the movie. And then they made another movie of it in the 50s with Donald O'Connor and Bing Crosby again. Also on a ship. Also has a couple of Cole Porter songs. And it has a script by Sidney Sheldon, who went on to create I Dream of Jeannie, Heart to Heart, and then write all these giant romantic potboilers. It's really weird. It's not a good movie. Don't watch that. Don't do it. You don't want to.
One of my observations in listening to it and is that it's not that the songs aren't distinctive, but I can totally see how the book gets changed a lot, and that like they even rewrite it and use some of the same songs for different movie adaptations in quotes,
right?
Because I feel like a lot of them are very easily adjusted to different plot lines, and they're sort of they each song sort of has like a single idea that they're putting forward rather than a particular plot point.
Right. They're very straightforward. They're, you know, oh, I love you, or we're good friends, or hey, let's go sleep around. They couldn't say it quite like that. Or you're the best person I know and I'm not that great. No, you're the best person I know and I'm not that great. And then some of them are just, you know, hey, we're on a boat. And then you have things like Blow Gabriel Blow, which is kind of random. But, you know, if Reno Sweeney weren't an Amy Semple McPherson type, there's no reason for her to have a song like that. It's almost like that's the reason that they made her that, because they just had this song and they really wanted to use it. I don't know. It's really weird. And then you have to have a song for the older criminal, and it's fine. It's fine. It fits. It's a little advice song. And you have to have, let's see. I mean, there are songs that change gender from version to version. There are songs that change character from version to version. And then there are songs that only appear in the 1960s version that they just, you know, picked up from other shows. It's really odd. It's really odd. And even then, they shift from character to character, even though they were never in the original show. It's kind of like a Rubik's Cube of musical theater.
Mm-hmm. And it's written as like an original musical, but it's almost a little bit like a review musical. It's like, here's a bunch of Cole Porter songs and here's a plot to put them together.
Yeah. And even more so in the 60s version, they, like I said, they camped it up, but they also made it much more of a review.
Hmm.
And I don't know if you've heard of Dames at Sea.
I have not.
That was also, I mean, that was kind of a spoof of this kind of show. It's also set on a ship at sea, obviously.
And, I'd be concerned if they weren't on a ship.
It's an adaptation of the movie Lifeboat? No. And if I'm not mistaken, that's where Bernadette Peters got her start in legit musical theater. But it is intentionally super campy and making fun of the conventions of this kind of show, where it's like, oh, we're going to sing a song that has nothing to do with anything. And so the 60s version of Anything Goes really kind of inspired that, I think. And the original version, very similar to that. I've got the John McGlynn super reconstructed, or, you know, the entire original score with the London Philharmonic. And it also, that version does not play all that well either. The 1987 and the slightly revised 2011 versions are much more cohesive. They do a better job of finding who should sing this song and when they should sing it. And it's much more integrated. It's much more coherent. But it's still the same songs, right? Mm-hmm. It's so weird. It's so weird. Everybody has their own Anything Goes, I think.
In a previous episode this season, we were talking about the musical Chess, which is another show that's been rewritten many times. But in it, that Chess is rewritten more because the book is bad, and so they keep trying to fix it. Whereas this just feels like what it is so much more fluid, because Anything Goes originally came out before Oklahoma, before the real rise of the integrated musical, when everything was put together like in these particular pieces, and so it just lends itself more to different interpretations.
Well, and originally what happened was the P.G. Wodehouse version of the show was written about a shipwreck. Right? Mm-hmm. A ship that went down and everybody's stranded on an island. And it has the same, again, it has the same characters and it has mostly the same songs. And I'm not sure of the timeline exactly. I don't know if it was like a month before or a few weeks or what. But the Moro Castle went down off the coast of New Jersey. And everyone involved said, oh, we cannot do a show about a ship going down. Okay. So they rewrote it almost on the spot, and that I think that's part of why it feels so ramshackle at first, and why they keep revising it, because it was never meant to be exactly that in the first place, and it wasn't as polished, it wasn't as good as it could have been, and so each version has gotten a little better until the mid-80s. In the mid-80s, there's a reason that thing ran. It was not meant to be a long-running show. It was at Lincoln Center, and it just kept going and going and going, and everybody loved it. And it transferred to London, and it kept going and going and going. But partly because, yes, it's a crowd-pleaser. Yes, it's got really great songs, but it finally has a script that's worthy of the songs.
That's all we can hope for.
That's right. That's right.
Maybe one day Chess will achieve this.
Nope. I mean, I think the first time I listened to Chess was about 34 years ago. But it can happen. I mean, it was 43 years until this had a good script, so.
And I mean, the same thing kind of happened with the Anything Goes revival as well. Like, it was originally intended to just be a pretty short, limited run. And then we're like, oh, let's play for like an extra year.
Right. It's just a fun show. One of the things I'm doing coming up for the radio theater, we're going to be doing a live radio theater episode with original music in New York City sometime later this fall, this winter, fall, winter, finter, wall, not sure. But at a very, very nice place in Midtown. And part of the plot, you know, you can't do a musical theater episode in the middle of New York City and not do a Broadway thing. So it's about a murder mystery set at a theater where two shows are vying for this empty space, one of which is a show very much like Anything Goes, and the whole point is that it's a crowd pleaser, right? It's this big, happy, fun show. And the other one is this crazy idea, a biography of Alexander Hamilton. But, you know, it's 1947, so of course that would be crazy then. So it's going to be a lot of fun, I think. But as soon as I knew that that was the story I wanted to do, I was like, well, the crowd pleaser has to be a shipboard thing.
Absolutely. Even if you just look at the, in popular culture section of the Anything Goes Wikipedia page, it's massive, because this has just become... Even if people don't know anything about the show, just Anything Goes and the entire musical theater genre that it perfected / inspired is like so ingrained in popular culture.
Right, right.
And of course, they did it on Glee, so.
Well, there you go. I maintain the best part of Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom is not... I mean, yes, the whole Club Obi-Wan section is the only really fun part of the movie, but the absolute best part of the movie is that very opening where they do the song Anything Goes in Chinese, in I believe Mandarin, I'm not sure. Mm-hmm. And I used to know how to sing it phonetically.
Oh my gosh.
It's been too long. I love it. I love it. Even though there's a lot of, you know, photo trickery and reverse film and, but it's Spielberg getting to do this big Busby Berkeley style number, and he has a lot of fun with it. And, you know, the whole thing with Busby Berkeley movies is that there is no way you could do this in a real theater. And so Spielberg embraces it. If you pay attention, there's no way they could do this in this little tiny club in Shanghai. But who cares? Because it's fun. And what do you pick for a fun song? Anything Goes. That's it.
That's so great. I'm going to have to look that up. I've never actually seen Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom. I've seen all of the other Indiana Jones movies. But when we watched the first one, and then my parents are like, the second one is bad. We're not watching it.
Fair enough. I mean, you can just watch the very opening with the music number, and then you're done.
There we go.
It's fine. But yeah, it's delightful. And I think I did actually squeak when I saw that. I don't squeak at many things, but that was like, I'm going into this expecting this, you know, it's an Indiana Jones film. You know what that is. And there's Cole Porter. Oh my God. Anyway, hi.
I love how excited you are about this. It's so great.
I never get to talk about this on podcasts. This is wonderful.
This is why I made this show, just so I could listen to everyone be excited about stuff.
Yeah, I mean, I can geek out about musicals for days on end without stopping. Maybe just for a drink every now and then. Because I mean, I love. Well, I fell in love with Cole Porter particularly because of the wordplay, the internal rhyme schemes, the wit. And then going forward, you know, Sondheim is much more serious and much more dense, but he still has that sense of rhyme and rhythm and wordplay. And Lin-Manuel Miranda, same thing, right? It's all this internal, like these incredible houses of cards of lyrics and sounds and syllables. And for me, it all started with Porter. And I can see that in other kinds of music, too. You know, it's not just musical theater, but it's prevalent in musical theater. And there are people who get involved in musical theater where I'll go, oh, John Mellencamp, no, don't do that. And then there are others who I'm like, oh, thank God you're doing this. So, yeah, it's fun to watch that. But, yeah, it's there's something about Porter that he's the only one that I own the complete lyrics book of.
Wow.
I might get the Sondheim ones because Sondheim, come on. But yeah, I bought that in 1989 and I've like, it's falling apart. I've poured through it so much. And there are some throwaway songs. There are songs that have never seen the light of day with some brilliant lyrics. And then there are some forgotten songs. I love when I get to perform, I love bringing out some forgotten Porter. I understand people who love Glee. I kind of hate the show Glee, but I understand it. I get it.
Glee is such a particular thing. I feel like every LGBTQ and or musical theater child in a certain age just like obligatory had a Glee phase, myself included.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It's not, in the contract.
It's just like it, like quality of the show, like, regardless of the quality of the show and anything, like, you just, like, required to have the Glee face.
Right. And I will say, musically, I totally, it's they did a really good job with that. I was not so much a fan of the writing all the time. And just the I don't want to say earnestness, but there was just something about it that drove me up the wall. But musically, I never had a problem with it. And they did. They did bring out interesting songs and interesting combinations of songs. So
it was a beautiful, beautiful mess.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's a Ryan Murphy show.
Yeah.
Anyway, you're listening to TV on the... Anyway.
This show is about whatever we want it to be about. An interesting note about Cole Porter as well is that he was... There's a particular line in his Wikipedia page. His parties were extravagant and scandalous, with much gay and bisexual activity, Italian nobility, cross-dressing, international musicians, and a large surplus of recreational drugs. And I'm like, all right, like, who had that on the bingo card?
Yeah, he knew how to party. My mother, I love my mother. She's wonderful. She was wonderful. One year for Christmas, she got me a very extensively researched biography of Cole Porter. And I really did not need to read all the details. I could have gone with the Wikipedia level. I could have gone with just, you know, a nice gloss and here, give me the songs. I won't go into details because I don't think we have an explicit tag. But he had a couch that had a name, and I can't say the name without an explicit tag. And I just didn't need that detail in my head.
Cole Porter and Oscar Wilde are from different eras, but I feel like they would have gotten along really well.
Oh, I think so. I would love to have dinner with them.
Oh, are you boy.
Whenever they say, you know, who are the famous people in history you'd like to have dinner with? Yeah, right there. Right there. I would go to that.
And I feel like with all of Cole Porter's extravagant and sometimes censored life, really informed a lot of his bit madcap farce writing.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there are some lyrics that, I mean, in Kiss Me, Kate, when they made the movie version, they had to edit some of the lyrics and change them. And there is some in there that nobody noticed. And it was clearly intentional. And, I mean, he loved doing that. He loved messing with people like that. I mean, the song Tom, Dick, or Harry in Kiss Me, Kate. See, we're going to need the explicit tag again. Because it's, I'm a maid who wouldst marry and would no longer tarry. I'm a maid mad to marry and would take double quick any Tom, Dick, or Harry. Any Tom, Harry, or Dick. Any Harry, Dick, or Tom. I forget now how it gets to it. But yes, Harry, Dick, or Tom. And the first time I played the 1940s movie, not the Broadway version that they recorded a few years ago. I played the movie for my 16-year-old, and he's not quite paying attention until that pops out. And he just started cracking up on the couch. He's like, I didn't think movies could do that then. I said, nope, they really couldn't, but Cole Porter could. You know, it's a terrible line. It's not even his most clever line, but it snuck through.
Getting around the censorship laws of that era was an art form in itself.
Oh, God, yes. And he took great glee in that. I'm trying to think of another good example of that. I mean, there are things from Can Can that, there are songs that got cut from Can Can. Si vous aimez mes poitrines, which is basically, do you like my breasts? That's the name of the song.
Good start.
But it's okay in French. We don't know French, right? There's some delightfully lewd lyrics all the way through his stuff. And, I mean, there's even a, it could be apocryphal. No one has been able to verify it, but there is a delightfully filthy verse for You're the Top that is clever enough that it's plausible. And they include it in the complete lyrics book because it is so plausible. And it is one of the filthiest sets of lyrics I've ever heard. But it fits. And it's like, yeah, I can buy it. I don't know if it was really him, but it's plausible. I could sing parts of that, too. Oh, man, we're going to need the tag.
There's going to be there might be a bit of bleeping in this episode.
Oh, yes.
While we still have some time, I want to get into a couple of the plot elements of this show, which we haven't been talking about too much, largely because they're somewhat unimportant beyond the understanding that this is a wild farce.
Well, and the beautiful thing is, so you always had a song that was going to be the hit, right? It was very clear that this was going to be the one that sold all the sheet music.
Mm-hmm.
And I Get a Kick Out of You, as soon as they all heard it, they're like, this is the song. This is the song. Where are we going to put it? We want to highlight it in as best of fashion as we can, because everybody is going to be singing this song. And it was Porter's idea to put that as the very first song in the show, because, and this is where he was a little different from a lot of the composers at the time, he moved in high society. He knew all these people, and he knew that they made a big deal about coming a few minutes late to the show so they could make a big splashy entrance. Oh, look, look, it's the Astors. Oh, look, they're coming in. And it would distract from everything. And he said, I would like to put this as the very first song and do it early enough that they all miss it. So nice. The next day when everyone is like, oh my God, did you hear the song? I get a kick out of you. Oh my God. And all of his friends, all of his society swells were like, what? That wasn't in the show. And they'd hear it and go, that's a really good song. Why wasn't it in the show? It's like, yes, it was in the show. You missed it.
That's brilliant.
And it really is. Cause it's like, why is this? Again, it throws off the structure of the script. There's no reason for it to be there. And it doesn't, because of its placement, it doesn't have anything to do with the plot. And of course, plot integrated songs were not quite a thing yet, despite Showboat. I mean, Showboat's really the first one that makes a point of that. But thank you, Oscar Hammerstein. And then you don't really have that again, truly, until you have Rodgers and Hammerstein working together. But there are some Porter songs that do work intentionally in a script. Not so much in this one, but he was getting there too. I mean, Kiss Me Kate is fairly well integrated. You can't rearrange Kiss Me Kate.
Yeah, yeah. By the time you got into later work, it was really there.
Yeah.
I'm just personally offended by the idea of someone deliberately showing up to a Broadway show late as someone right? who very recently ran 15 minutes in the rain barefoot to make it to the show on time. It was Hamilton, though, so.
Oh, well, yeah.
Literally barefoot. I was so disgusting.
I was in the city this weekend, and I took my obligatory shot outside the Richard Rogers Theater with a sad face saying, I still don't get to see Hamilton.
Oh. There is a particular element in this show that I wanted to make sure we talk about, which is okay. Like a very weird plot line in the second act that involves Yellowface and like Chinese stereotyping and Chinese identity. And it's very much like in history of like a 1930s farce. But in modern context, you're like, what is going on?
This is the point where we very, very quietly and calmly say, this was a musical of its time.
Mm-hmm.
And then we just sort of let it go. It's problematic. The original movie version embraces it fully. And even the 1987 version has a little bit of it, but not, I mean, they excised as much as they could. And yeah, that's one of the reasons it really needed revision. It just, I don't think it was probably very funny at the time even. Cause it's not even in the 1980s, you could look at it and go, no. And certainly not today. It just doesn't work.
Yeah, I don't know how like the 1987-2011 version dealt with it, because I don't know. I'm not familiar with those versions.
Right. It's pretty much gone. It's pretty much gone.
That makes sense.
Yeah, yeah. And maybe, again, maybe that's part of why it ran so long both times, is that it just wasn't uncomfortable. And it certainly wasn't necessary to the plot, what plot there is.
I feel like 80% of this musical can just be summed up with antics.
Yeah, yeah, it's shtick. It's shticky. It's, like you said, it very much plays like a review. I mean, Friendship, You're the Top, It's the Lovely. All of these songs are, they're there. They fit in the plot, but they don't need the plot. They make sense without the plot. You're the Top is an excuse to just list all things, all bunch of things that rhyme.
In a very catchy way, though.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, and these, that's the other thing about Porter songs, is these are songs I love to sing. They're just fun, right? You know, you're the top.
You're the Colosseum. You're the top. You're the Louvre Museum. You're a melody.
You're the boats that glide on the sleepy Zuider Zee. You're an old Dutch master, you're Lady Astor, you're broccoli. I mean, they're ridiculous, but it just flows. And I don't even know if that was a proper verse, but you can mix and match the verses like a Rubik's Cube. You know, they all pretty much fit together. And it's lovely. I mean, oh.
It's delightful.
It's delirious. it's D-Lore. Woo! Thank you.
Hey.
Thank you. But even the more obscure songs in this one are kind of delightful. Buddy Beware, which I didn't know until Lincoln Center. That's not from the original, but it is... Oh, no, I guess it is from the original. That's one of the ones that was originally a song for Reno, and then it becomes Moonface Martin's Moll, who's also there. She's kind of a gold digger type.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're just fun. I want to row on the crew, mama. You know, they had to have a song for the guy from Yale. That's the thing that makes him happy. Let's see. Easy to Love is, it was originally in the show in 1934 and it got cut. And it first saw the light of day in a movie from 1936 called Born to Dance with Jimmy Stewart in a musical. This is when he was still a contract player. It's Jimmy Stewart, Eleanor Powell, and Buddy Ebsen.
I'm sure you
and it's another Shipboard thing, although it has nothing to do with this. And there's a ridiculous song about a Pekingese dog named Cheeky. It's not a very good movie. But Jimmy Stewart sings the song Easy to Love, which is one of my very favorite Cole Porter songs. And they put that back in to the 1987 version. Again, they weren't just like sticking songs in willy-nilly. This actually had a place in Anything Goes originally, so it's like, let's figure out how to put it back in, because it's a great song. It's not just a song about, hey, let's get it on, right? Which a fair number of Porter songs are, to be fair. But this one is, it's not about some goofy version of love. It's about, I would like to be domestic with you. I would like to love you for everything, right? Not just glamour and dressing up and dancing on a ship, right? Which is a really interesting choice. And the way they used it in the 87 version really builds that character. It's the first moment where we see Billy is not just society layabout, right? He actually loves Hope. And he's never been able to quite verbalize that until now. But yeah, I mean, you've got so many other songs. I mean, Blow Gabriel Blow is a great song. I don't think it really has anything to do with anything, but it's a great song. And that's the reason they had Patti LuPone in 87. Cause you need someone who can blow the roof off the place. And then, This is Moonface's song from the second act, where you always have that sort of lull in classic musical comedy patterns, where, you know, it's where you have a really slow song in Guys and Dolls. It's where you have a really slow song in Kiss Me, Kate. This is the really slow song here that has nothing to do with anything. But it's when Billy and Moonface are stuck in the jail, the brig on the ship, because they've been found out. It's like, oh, you're really public enemy, but you're not all that hot, and you're an imposter and a stowaway. So they're trapped there, and Moonface is trying to cheer him up and say, you know, as my mother used to say, it's always darkest just before they turn out the light. And and then the song kicks in. There's an old Australian bush song, and I'm going to sing it badly because you can't sing it well. That's the whole point of the character.
Okay.
There's an old Australian bush song that Melba used to sing. A song that always cheered me.
A song that always cheered me when I was blue. Even Melba said this bush song was a hell of a song to sing. So be quiet whilst I render it for you. When your instinct tells you that disaster is approaching you faster and faster, then be like the bluebird and sing tweet, tweet, tra-la, tra-la, tra-la.
And yes, it is intentionally supposed to be sung poorly because Moonface is not a singer. But it's just, it's a lovely little song. It's, and you know, it's the dumbest thing. It's an earworm for me. It's not a great song, but it's an earworm, and it's a really sweet kind of, you know, it's a song to cheer you up. It's a song, it really does cheer you up when you're blue, because you think about that and you go, in the worst moment, in the lowest moment, I can sing, I can have some joy. I mean, it really is a feel-good show. That gets thrown around a lot, and it does apply to a lot of Broadway shows, but man, this is like the original feel-good show. I mean, even just the song Anything Goes. We haven't even talked about the song Anything Goes, which is fantastic. The world has gone mad today, and good's bad today, and day's white today,
and night's white today, and day's night today, when most guys today, that women prize today, are just silly gigolos. And though I'm not a great romancer, I know that I'm bound to answer when you propose. Anything goes.
You know, it just flows, and it's fast, and it has, again, it has several verses.
And it is so fun, and it's stuck in my head this entire time and will continue to be.
You know, if affairs you like with young bears you like, why nobody will oppose. And again, that's, you know, you listen to it and you go, bears. And then when you think about his hard partying lifestyle and you go, oh, bears. Because that was a term then, too. That was not a recent thing. So, yeah, it's like he would sneak all those things in, too. When Grandmama, whose age is 80, in nightclubs is getting matey with gigolos, anything goes. And everyone, the set, the smart, is intruding in nudist parties in studios. I mean, all of that internal rhyme, my God! And it's fun. It's fun writing fake Porter lyrics, just because you get to think in those terms and try to fit those syllables together.
Of course, when I sing this song right now, it mostly sounds like anything goes.
Well, I still remember very clearly, like I was saying about James McMullen and his Lincoln Center posters. They did a really, really smart campaign for it when it first came out, where, I mean, the New York Times Arts and Leisure section was filled with ads for this. And they would have variations on the poster art and, you know, similar pieces of poster art. And they would also include the lyrics. So you'd have like a snippet of one verse going across the top of the page or going across the top of the ad. And you just got bits and pieces. You didn't get the whole thing at any one time. But it was just sort of like, oh, yeah, I remember this. So, yeah, it's a song that Reno gets to sing. Because it's a song you want your belter to sing. And so she just, she's kind of preaching at the beginning. And I won't even do that part, but just times have changed, and we've often rewound the clock.
Since the Puritans got a shock when they landed on Plymouth Rock. If today any shock they should try to stem, instead of landing on Plymouth Rock. Stocking was looked on as something shocking, but now God knows anything goes.
If driving fast cars you like, if low bars you like, if old hymns you like, if bare limbs you like, if Mae West you like, or me undressed you like, why nobody will oppose. When every night the set that's smart is intruding in nudist parties and studios, anything goes. And then the other lyric, I mean, there are several other lyrics, several other verses that just go into all the society names, because that was a thing he loved doing. You know, if Sam Goldwyn with conviction instruct Aniston in diction, then Anna shows anything goes. When you hear that Lady Mendel standing up, now turns a handspring landing upon her toes. Anything goes. Just think of those shocks you've got, and those knocks you've got, and those blues you've got from that news you've got, and those pains you've got, if any brains you've got, from those little radios. So Mrs. R, with all her trim and skin, broadcast a bed from Simmons, 'cause Franklin knows anything goes. And a certain amount of that makes no sense to us today. But I know that, you know, Eleanor Roosevelt did a thing about a bed from Simmons. Okay. You know. Doesn't mean anything to us.
I just really want to know a lot of pop culture references from the 20s. That's my goal,
right?
In life.
Right? I mean, you kind of need them. The world has gone mad today, and good's bad today. Black's white today, day's night today. And that gent today you gave a cent today once had several chateaus. When folks who still can ride in jitneys find out Vanderbilts and Whitneys lack baby clothes, anything goes. So bear in mind, this is written right on top of the Great Depression. Things have gone crazy. And then on top of it, you know, again, I think part of the popularity of it over the years, and certainly at the time, is that Cole Porter's a little naughty. Gershwin didn't get naughty. You know, Kern didn't get naughty. But Porter would get naughty. And, you know, it's like everybody talks about Ira Gershwin. I don't not like Ira Gershwin. God, please. I don't want to perpetuate that. But I don't really like Ira Gershwin. And it's because his lyrics are fine. They're good. But, you know, and everyone's like, oh, Gershwin music and, you know, Gershwin's better than Porter. Well, musically, he's a genius. It's fantastic. Rhapsody in Blue is amazing. Even the more obscure Second Rhapsody and Cuban Overture, it's fantastic stuff. But to me, the most clever lyric Ira Gershwin ever wrote was, blah, 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 your hair, blah, 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 your eyes, blah, 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 care, blah, 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 skies. Right? The joke is that I can put anything in a lyric in a love song. It doesn't matter, right? That's clever. That's like, okay, good for you, Ira. Whereas Porter is actually spitting out. I mean, he's, in a way, he's like the Lin-Manuel of his time, right? He's spitting out all these references, all these rhymes, all this internal rhythm and rhyme. There was nobody like him even then. I kind of like the guy. It's true.
Just a little bit. Just a little bit of a fan.
Just a little bit.
Okay.
Okay.
Are you ready for the lightning round?
As ready as I'll ever be.
Your favorite song.
Okay, my favorite song from the show would probably be Anything Goes. I mean, they're all great. They are. They really are. But Anything Goes is the one with the most sparkling wit and the most speed. It's the most fun to sing. They're all fun to sing, but this is, I mean, clearly, I just sang the whole first verse because I love the damn song.
Yeah. And your favorite line from the show?
Oh, God!
This might be a hard one.
Wow. It might be, I mean, it just might be that whole first verse. That whole, just that cascade of rhymes and... You know, it's been long enough since I saw the show itself, and you can't just buy the book of it like we can with modern shows. I actually looked at the Drama Bookshop in New York City this weekend, and no, you can't. Yeah. Oh, and the irony, all these years living here, never been a fan of going to the local High School Musical. What do they do the one weekend I'm away the whole time? Anything Goes.
Aww.
And they did it with a really good poster, too. I was impressed. They don't usually have good posters. Hello, high school. Sorry.
It's like, wow, way to dunk on your local high school.
Oops. Oops.
Who's your favorite character in the show?
It would probably be Billy, only because I really have always wanted to be him. I've always wanted to play that role. From the outside, it might be Sir Evelyn, only because that's the comedy role. Well, it's one of the comedy roles.
Mm-hmm.
And he gets to sing The Gypsy in Me and dance. And it's like, and sort of surprising people, which I like to do.
Well, my next question was, who would you want to play in the show?
Oh, well, Billy Crocker.
There you go.
you know, because he gets, well, see, it's he gets to be Fred Astaire the whole time, right?
Oh, yeah.
Sir Evelyn gets to bring it out, and he gets to be funny up until then, because he's very much a fussy British man. You could see David Hyde Pierce doing a really good job with that. And then suddenly being suave and debonair when it counts. So that would be a lot of fun, but you don't get to do as much. You don't get to be Fred Astaire the whole time, and I would kind of like to be mm-hmm. Fred the whole time.
Who would you recommend go see this show?
Everybody! Oh my God, it's so much fun. It's not so naughty that kids would be scandalized or parents would be scandalized by what their kids are hearing. I'm sure there are some who might. Just, you don't go to Broadway shows anyway, so just leave me alone. But, you know, it's funny naughty. You know, if your kids are at just the right age, they might start to figure out some things. It's probably okay. They probably already know more than that. But, you know, it's just the whole plot of mistaken identity and assuming identities is easy to follow. It's very silly. It's not heavy. It's a great gateway musical for kids. So yeah, everybody can enjoy this show.
All right. Normally I don't accept that as an answer, but I will accept your reasoning.
If I could recommend it to anyone in particular, it would be my children.
Aww.
Come on, kids. It's not all Hamilton, for crying out loud.
And finally, if you could combine this show with another one, which one would you pick?
Assassins. No. but now I kind of want to see that. Wow, Assassins goes. Oh my God. What would I combine it with? That's a really good question. Not Pacific Overtures. You know, it would kind of be interesting to combine it with Follies, because mm-hmm. you get a dual timeline. You get history, you get present day, you get what happened to them. You know, that could be very interesting, and see them grown up and see them maybe it wasn't happily ever after decades later. That would be an interesting twist. It's kind of like there's a book called Gilligan's Wake, which kind of spoofs Finnegan's Wake, but it takes the characters from Gilligan's Island as absolutely serious human beings and places them in real historical contexts before and after they were on the island. And it's kind of trippy. I didn't like it all the way through, but it's a hell of a feat of writing and creativity. And so, yeah, this could be that kind of thing where it's taking the frothy, happy, bouncy 30s musical and Sondheiming it and saying, you know, what happened to them? What if they were real people? The stuff that happened in that musical does not happen in real life. Mm-hmm. Right. So
anything goes, the dark now. Version.
Yeah. Oh, man.
Yeah, so many that ideas. Would be a lot.
Look what you did. Look what you did. Okay.
All right. Thank you so much for joining me, David.
Anytime. Anytime.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Corner of the Sky. You can find us online at theincomparable.com/COTS or follow us on Twitter at COTS Podcast. If you'd like, you could also review us in Apple Podcasts or recommend us in Overcast. Until next time, remember that a co-porter can be absolutely filthy and a successful lyricist in the 1930s. You could do anything you put your mind to.